Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Risky Business.
Howdy, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Risky Business, hosted by Vigabyte Virtual Hosting and sponsored by Checkpoint Software. Now, earlier this week, I was in Sydney to attend the inaugural eCrime Symposium, where I recorded a bunch of the talks, and I'm planning to release some of these in Risky Business 2 over coming weeks. But look, before I get into what's coming up in this week's show, a bit of an apology because, like, this week's show, a little bit different. I wasn't able to put the news segment together because, as I said, I was in Sydney on Monday and Tuesday, and I've been suffering the effects of some bad chicken on Wednesday and Thursday. I'll spare you the details. And yes, tomorrow I'm moving house as well. So this week things have just got well and truly past me. So apologies for that. But we will be back next week with a bit of a wrap from all the shenanigans in Vegas and a proper news update. Just did not have time this week between everything that's happened. Now anyway, back to the eCrime Symposium stuff. And they put on a couple of panel discussions. And one of them, this one that I'm going to play you an excerpt from, I found very interesting. The speakers, Rachel Dixon, who's a technology executive here in Australia for online media group Viocorp, and she's also the deputy chair of Consumer Group Choice. We've also got Phil Argy, who's the head of the Technology Dispute Centre, and Sean Richmond from Sophos. You may have actually heard him on Risky Business before. The panel was hosted by Nigel Fair. Now, this was originally a one-hour session, but I've basically edited it down to focus on the comments of one panellist, and that being Rachel Dixon. I found her perspectives on eCrime to be very interesting. Now, there's nothing revolutionary about her thoughts, but she's just a good, interesting speaker. So I've chopped out 20 minutes for your listening pleasure. And here it is, an excerpt from the eCrime Symposium panel recorded on Tuesday in Sydney. Sean Richmond has the younger voice, the younger male voice, and Phil the older male voice. And if I have to tell you which one Rachel is, then I think you're in a bit of trouble. But here it is. Here it is, as recorded on Tuesday in Sydney. Enjoy.
One of two of the big trends that we've had in recent years is the rate of change increasing. And the second thing is the rise of the network effect. And one of those things is a tremendous sense of peril, tremendous sort of source of peril. The other one's a tremendous source of opportunity. What I will say first up, I think, is to reinforce what Graham Ingram said earlier this morning, which is that although organisations like Choice and plenty of other consumer groups do try and do a lot to educate consumers, if you're relying upon education to solve this problem, you've got rocks in your head. There's just no way that we can implement anything like the level of education, even if we could, that people would actually behave the way we wanted them to. There's a very famous line that a character in a Patrick White novel says, which is that I forget what I was taught, I only remember what I've learned. And that's absolutely true. People don't take instruction, particularly not in anything that's actually technically complex. And frankly, most of this stuff that's been talked about this morning would go over the head of 90% of the people in my extended family. And presumably 90% of the people in your extended family as well who probably ask you for advice on these sorts of things at barbecues. So let's not assume that the consumer is actually going to fix this. Let's put this in a context where, and one of the things that actually hasn't been talked a great deal about this morning, it's been touched on but not talked about in any detail, is identity theft. And this is getting a whole lot worse. It's going to get a whole lot worse. This is an environment where we've seen in the last couple of months, for example, the wife of the head of MI6 put things like her birthday up on Facebook, not realising that the London network included 4 million people. My sister has her birthday up on Facebook. This is madness. You know? But by default, people go on, they put this kind of information. Social networking is just making this much, much worse. The sorts of things that girls send over mobile phones to one another is just absolutely terrifying, the kind of information they share. Now, moreover, the network effect means that this information does not go away. Who's been online here for longer than the web's been around? Okay, reasonable smattering. Who thought, if you got involved in an internet flame war in 1987, that it would go away? Oh, good. Okay. Some people did. And in fact, I know a very talented web designer who is unable to get a job because of a flame war that she embarked upon when she was, I think, 17 online. Because After a couple of years, Dejan News came along and scooped up all of Usenet, and then Google News bought Dejan News, and now it's out there. And if you Google on her name, that's one of the things that comes up. And people in the web sphere almost always Google on employees' names before they hire them. That information's not going away. Because she can't prove it was her, Google won't remove it. Now, that network effect, that sort of persistence of information, is something that will have pluses and minuses. I think I don't agree with Philip's idea that we can educate our children better and get them to behave better. Teenagers particularly have an interesting moral compass, and that's an evolutionary process for them. What I think we can do, and this is the difference between the individual online and the idea, everybody's sort of convinced that the world is you know, there's this huge mass of people on the internet and therefore we're all terribly insignificant. In fact, what it is a set of communities. And in that sense, we're seeing in online communities the same kind of reinforcing kind of behaviours that villagers experience. And one of the things there is that over time, and bear in mind that most people have only been online for 12 or so years, most of the things that people have learned have not really embedded themselves in the culture yet. I think there is the potential that as people do learn, and they learn through meeting people and hearing stories about people and having experiences. So the way that young people learn what is a good thing and a bad thing to send over mobile phones is, in fact, through experience. And perhaps when their children have mobile phones, we'll get past some of the problems we've got at the moment. The other, while we're on to the issue of dealing with things on the network, there have been ideas around making identity theft harder to work on a technological basis. So using things like PKI, my mother is never going to use a certificate on her email. And if I filter email that doesn't have a certificate, I'm never going to get an email from my mother. So I'm not going to do that. And this, again, is one of the problems with the network effect, is that any security that you implement is only as strong as the weakest link. And this is why technological fixes take so long. So P3P, everybody's aware of P3P, which was the sort of vaguely abortive W3C initiative to get around sort of privacy, to sort of solve some privacy problems, stalled at version 1.1 because it was too hard to implement in various browsers. The browser manufacturers are just not really behind that kind of initiative. Technological change is so fast that getting the groundswell for that kind of adoption now, particularly where people are seeing market share, various vendors are seeing market share disappear, is just too hard. And by the time you implement this piece of technology, we'll be on to three new iterations of browsers or whatever other technology there is. So I'm not full of hope for those kinds of initiatives. I wish people who are doing them but frankly, you know, I'll be old and grey before there is a technological solution to this problem. It's absolutely about social behaviour. Likewise, so privacy agents, I just don't think. Privacy critics, so-called privacy critics, which is adaptive software to help you manage your privacy, I see as being a really good counter to things like the growth of intelligent agents. Because, of course, the other thing that nobody's touched on here yet is that we're about to see, well, we've already seen a rise in the last 2-3 years of technology mediated through software. So your experience with Google, most of your experiences with Google are mediated through software agents that Google deploys. And, you know, even if you're doing Amazon, if you're using Amazon and recommendations engine, you're working with the first generation of intelligent agents, and that technology dates from about 1995. There's a whole new wave of intelligent agents coming through, and the risks to consumer data and the way that that will influence consumer behaviour is profound, because the big change is going to be that people won't always understand when they're having a transaction. When we talk today, we're talking about this consciousness that you interact with your bank or your phone company or your brother or whatever, and you make a conscious choice to have that interaction. When a lot of these functions are automated, so for example, if you buy Mercedes-Benz now, you can get your Mercedes-Benz to essentially train itself to open your garage door when it's a kilometre away. You don't have to teach it to do that. It will learn how to do that. Mercedes-Benz are really big on intelligent agents. And that's the point, is once you've got network processing, you can learn behaviour rather than having to teach behaviour. So consumers won't know some of the time when they're having these interactions. And I think that's a huge element of risk for us in terms of managing consumer expectation and behaviour. The things that go with that, of course, is that consumers are increasingly giving up lots of information. Who's got one of these? Okay, you know, there's a piece of software on this that is developed by a company called Skyhook Systems out of the United States. So Apple don't use a telecommunications provider to do geo-targeting, right? They use essentially a network of learned wireless networks. This is actually really easy stuff to do. A friend and I tried to develop this about 4 years ago and gave up because Google was way ahead of us. But we paid taxi drivers to drive around with a laptop computer and a GPS device and a Bluetooth device in the back of their cab for a week. We gave them curry vouchers from Fahim's Fast Food. And what we developed was a wireless topography of Sydney. Because every time you take one of these wireless devices past a base station, there's a little transaction that says, oh, that's that base station. And in fact, the way Skyhook work is that they basically just have drivers driving around. They tried the cab route as well originally, but now they have their own drivers like Google. And they just drive around and around and around, and they map all the various wireless networks that are around. And they can tell where you are based on the triangulation of the various wireless networks that they know. So you've got this on your iPhone. It's on every iPhone that's ever been sold. I make this point not because it's a particularly sinister piece of software. It's the fabulous thing, for example, that allows you to use augmented reality applications on your iPhone, which heaven knows you're all going to love in about 2 years' time. Big trend. But just to say that you don't understand the transactions that your device is currently having. Really key. And you guys are experts. Most of you have no idea how much of yourself, if I was a direct marketer and wanted to license that kind of technology, I could, for example, figure out not only how you drive to work, but who you work with and who you sleep with and all of those sorts of things. And I can do that all on the network side. Should wrap this up very quickly because I'm talking way, way, way too much. Sorry about that. I think I'll actually stop and just, turn over to Sean. Sorry.
Thanks, Rachel. Because I'm a PC guy, I don't have an iPhone.
Hi, still Gerian from crikey.com.au, amongst other things. Rachel, I want to pick up on something you said about someone putting their birthday online being madness, or someone getting into trouble for something they said in an internet flame war than when they were 17 years old. Isn't the problem there really anyone who's stupid enough to still use someone's birthday as an authentication mechanism, like a telephone company not far from here? And isn't an employer the one who's being stupid by judging a potential employee on something they said when they were a child?
Yes,
isn't that where the problem is?
Yes and yes. On the identity theft issue and the date of birth thing, I got a call from a large American credit provider yesterday about my Visa card, and the first thing they asked me when they rang me was for me to give them my date of birth. I told them where to get off. And the problem for them, of course, is that the cost of running help centres is a gigantic cost for large corporations. Consequently, they outsource their help desks to low cost of operation areas. It's not to say the people who work in those centres are dumb, it's just that they have very, very clearly defined protocols for their work, and they're not given the freedom to vary the way that those things work. They're certainly not encouraged to do it. And what we've done as a society is to make a choice between the amount that we're... It's essentially just a cost of business. And we're making a choice that we want to spend very little on identity verification processes because near enough is good enough for the volume of fraud that we have. It's a cost-benefit analysis. Hmm. From my point of view, would I run a call centre? Would I run an online verification? My partner is... has just hit a certain age at which he's a bit older than me, at which his birth certificate is about to become available online for a fee of 99 cents. This is true of everybody in most Australian states above a certain age because there are lots of benefits to having this kind of historical data online. It helps you trace genealogy and all sorts of things like that. And I, for one, really enjoyed it when I was tracing my ancestry. But there's a risk. So, my husband's birth certificate will be online very soon. Getting his mother's maiden name is obviously trivial. Even for somebody who's not really interested in it, it would take me about 5 minutes, given what I know about you from Twitter and various other things, Stilgarian, take me about 5 minutes to probably reverse engineer your identity And you're probably more careful than most. It's a truly, but it's a cost benefit. It's pure and simple cost benefit. Now, as to employers going back that far in terms of web searches, this is Utah, and they have funny ideas in Utah.
No, really.
So, yeah, this particular woman was, in fact, going for a job in Utah. So people have... It's a remarkably conservative environment. I don't know if you've ever been to Salt Lake City, but they have special rules there.
Well, that's actually worth raising, is how many people would actually demand authentication of somebody calling to say, hey, there's a problem with your credit card? They ask for you to identify yourself to them, giving up all this information that can be used to identify you as a credit card applicant. How many people actually make the effort of identifying who the caller is?
Well, you can't.
That's a very good question. Yeah, I do. It results in lots of phone calls that shut down early.
Rachel's point is good. They call me and then demand that I prove
exactly
who I am. How bizarre is that? I mean, could be anybody.
Absolutely.
And they don't get it when you challenge them. Because it's not on their script.
Having said this, technology will take care of this in about 10 years' time.
Phil's universal PKI will.
No. part of the issue is that, approaching the kind of network singularity that Ray Kurzweil likes to talk about, where the network will know exactly who you are at all times. And this will probably be used for a really nasty... It's already being used for nasty, insidious purposes by direct marketers. You know, marketing people already know way more about you than you think that they do. And because the network gives us context and proximity to other people, the network is going to learn a whole lot more about you in the next 3-4 years, including who you sleep with. I mean, we've already seen court cases, for example, where they've subpoenaed things like e-tags. This happened 10 years ago in New York, and it was the first case where a wife subpoenaed the e-tag records, the E-ZPass records from her husband's car to prove that he'd been driving across to see his mistress every night, because New York doesn't have no-fault divorce. All of these things are coming. We won't need PKI because at a certain point there'll be big enough network operators that will actually verify your identity, and they will know based on essentially all of the other stuff, the historical stuff that they know about you, and that's much harder to gain.
And how are you going to establish trust with them?
It's a matter of making the opportunities less, increasing the probability of detection. That's sort of stuff I'm talking about. Certainly not a silver bullet. I mean, let me pick up on your comment about your mother would never use PKI. That's not your mother's fault. That's the fault of the publisher of the software she's using. It's got to be as easy for her to do tomorrow as it is today. All I'm saying is, behind the scenes, there needs to be PKI or something going on that makes it more likely than not that that email is from your mother and not from your brother.
PKI has been on the board since, what, 1995?
Oh, way before that.
No, but bilaterally.
Yeah. Why has it failed to be adopted in 15 years?
Because
what makes
haven't
you
got
think...
a public key lookup table.
Because it's hard. It's complex to establish the trusts and then to keep them. DNSSEC is an excellent example. It's been going on for years to actually verify that this is the person that their DNS record says it is. So when you go to a website, it makes it much harder for somebody to spoof that and pretend to be a different website based on DNS lookup. And no one can agree on who's going to look after the lookup tables. So it's only just starting to be deployed now. It's been on the cards for, I don't know, about 6-7 years. So these kinds of things, until there's pressure to do it, the overcoming the inertia is the hard part, and trying to establish trust until it's absolutely necessary. So I think Phil's right on the ethics of things. People behave far more differently when they're anonymous. And if they, as Nicholas Cowdery said, people think they can easily get away with something, they will engage in behaviour that they would not possibly consider in their normal everyday life.
Consider the cost-benefit issues, though, around anonymity. I mean, there is a definite benefit to society of
absolutely
enabling anonymity. There are obviously risks, but I bet Malcolm Turnbull wishes that Godwin and Gretsch had done things a little bit differently. But, you know, in terms of disclosure if you're talking about coming up against entrenched interests, then anonymity is a great protection against
absolutely
entrenched power. And taking that away disturbs the balance of society in a fairly profound way as well. I'm not going to argue the libertarian stance that everything should be absolutely open, but I think trying to work towards locking everything down is inherently probably... Well, I don't actually think it's achievable anyway. I mean, I think that people are going to reverse engineer
it. It's no different to international travel and passports and you know, adding biometrics to passports. It's not foolproof. It doesn't prevent terrorism. It just makes it harder and changes the dynamic a little bit. And I agree, it's a cost-benefit analysis. And until we can do it easily and cheaply and it becomes the norm, people won't do it.
I think it's absolutely necessary for businesses to conduct...
And until the price we pay for e-crime gets to a point where... then the cost of
doing
something makes
worthwhile.
Sense, it won't happen. I agree. I'm just saying that's where we're headed. When we reach that crossover point, you'll see something happen. And then your mother will use it.
And I think this is the thing, is that people develop things... They develop things first and they discover the consequences later.
But that's
and
that was history.
That was part of my point about the rate of change increasing. And if you look at the... if you look at the IEEE annual conference on intelligent agents, you know, there's more than 200 papers presented every single year about new ideas for mediating between man and machine. And so the rate of change in that area alone is just phenomenal. And people won't understand, because let's face it, most people who work in technology, with the exception of people who are into information architecture as an actual kind of like, you know, they live and breathe it, most of us who work in technology don't understand how people are going to work with the technology that we deploy. We only find out when they start using it. And sometimes, as in the case of Twitter, using SMS, for example, they use it for things that we never anticipated. And those factors are not technological. Sometimes the reason SMS became so popular outside the US originally, for example, was that the business model for cell phones was different in the United States. So SMS usage in the United States was actually quite low originally. The reason the Japanese consume huge amounts of media on their cell phones has almost nothing to do with Japanese culture. It has everything to do with the fact that you're not allowed to talk on a mobile phone on Japanese public transport, so you may as well watch something. So all of those sorts of factors, not just technological. We don't know when we deploy a technology how people are going to work on it. We only find out by accident. Google probably now wants to black out the... would probably, given their druthers, might approach certain other things differently from a privacy point of view. But they probably didn't think about somebody kind of trying to track people by their number plates in the first instance. And the first thing you do with software is you release it in its earliest form, and Google particularly do this. They release everything in what they call beta and figure it out later. And that's a whole... That's been a particular trend most software developers in the last 5 or 6 years is you put it out early, you figure out how people work with it, then you release the next version and the next version and the next version, and you learn from your audience.
Should we do that with a swine flu vaccine? Should we do that with genetic engineering, with nanotechnology? I mean,
yeah, but they're important. Software's not important.
but that's, like, that's the interesting thing. We are really very inconsistent with our approach
absolutely
to a lot of things.
And the other thing is that the criminals live in the areas where the mental models that are promulgated, such as a PDF, is a piece of paper. How many people sort of pretty much think of PDFs that way? And it's not. There's a whole bunch of stuff underneath it that can be exploited by bad guys that almost no one knows about because we're not experts, so we just make it the same as the physical world. And I think software engineering needs to get a bit cleaner to prevent that kind of misuse of the mental models.
That was a panel session recorded at Sydney's inaugural e-crime symposium in Sydney on August 4. And that was Sean Richmond you heard at the end there. I know it's a little bit different for Risky Business, but I hope you enjoyed it anyway. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview, and this week's episode of Risky Business is brought to you by Checkpoint Software. Now, normally we'd speak to one of their staff or one of their experts about their perspective on recent goings-on, but this week we're trying something different. We're having a chat to Tim Smith, who is a director of Bridgepoint, a Checkpoint Gold partner. Tim is at the coalface of the Australian security industry, so we took this opportunity to get a commercial perspective on what's happening out there in the market, and in particular with PCI. Now, as you'll hear, Tim says all sorts of organisations, from online retailers right down to corner stores, are actually being roped into the regime, which obviously makes life interesting when you're dealing with people who've never had to confront security before. He joined me by phone on Wednesday for this interview.
Well, certainly, you know, a lot of the calls that we've had are, you know, help. We've got this self-assessment form that we need to fill in. And now we're getting down to a corner shop in Bowen potentially calling and, you know, requiring help. So it's actually become, it's interesting, it's actually morphed into kind of an advisory service and a consulting service. So one being an opportunity to assist clients on filling out the forms themselves, giving them advice on what to look at, what they need to do. The other actually either doing the whole thing for them from a gap analysis perspective and then a mitigation perspective or, you know, somewhere in between. But yes, it's certainly opened up a different demographic.
Do you think it's a sad day when a corner shop from Bowen Hills is being forced into a data security compliance regime?
No, I think you've got to put that into context, and PCI is all about context. It's all about where that credit card data information is stored and what is stored and where it's travelling. Quite often, it's more where we're seeing more of the issue, I guess, is around aggregators. So they may be an aggregator, and a lot of that may be outsourced. So now we need to make sure that they're, you know, what other businesses is that actually touching? It's probably got a call centre associated with it. It's probably got a hosting company associated with it. That's why you're seeing now, I don't know whether you saw yesterday, Earthwave, the managed security service out of Sydney, have become PCI certified. So the idea being that they could then offer, you know, that component as a certified solution to their clients. The point is that it's all these organisations need to be compliant, but the actual complexity behind it varies depending on what you're doing. So it's a completely different variable to the, you know, the corner shop in Bowen as it is to a major corporation.
So if you had to break it down at a guess, how much of your business do you think comes from organisations that are seeking to be PCI DSS certified or rubber stamped?
At the moment, well, if I take the networking side of our business out, so if we just look at security from a services perspective, it's probably about 25%.
Well, I suppose, I mean, that's a market that just didn't even exist really in Australia a few years ago, so it must be a nice little kick to the bottom line.
It's really just an extension of what we've been doing, you know. Nothing's changed. Best practice hasn't changed. There's just a compelling event has actually occurred, and it's been around for some time. It's just, for some reason, just getting a fair amount of press now. But, you know, it's not something that magically landed on our lap. As with all of these standards, we had to, you know, do and as we do, part of what we do is evangelising the requirements for security. It's just that this was, you know, something a bit deeper than that, I guess.
Do you actually feel that PCI goes far enough in some circumstances, or do you think it's a little bit gappy in places?
I think it's pretty good as a general model. However, you know, it's not everything, and I think perhaps the danger is we've done that now. We've ticked it off, which can happen with compliance, right? You know, we've done that now. Let's move on. But the thing is, it's a living, breathing thing, and if you take the right approach to information security and data security, then the fact you're complying with PCI is just one part of the puzzle.
Well, I would have thought if you're doing things the right way, then being PCI compliant is just a matter of ticking the boxes and going, yep, we're doing that, we're doing that, we're doing that, we're doing that, we were doing that anyway, and we've been doing that for 3 years.
Well, yeah. To a large degree it is. However, it's still specific to, you know, cardholder data. There's what about the, you know, the client's own data? You know what I mean?
I do. And it's often struck me as odd that we've got PCI DSS for credit card information, and yet we don't seem to have any equivalent government standard or government mandated standard for personally identifiable information, even though this is the stuff that is being used by a lot of identity fraud rings to perpetrate massive amounts of fraud. Do you think that it would be an idea at least an idea, at least something worth considering to introduce a similar set of compliance burdens for businesses that process personally identifiable information, like date of birth, mother's maiden name, things like that?
Yeah, well, I think we're going to see a certain amount of that with, once the new Privacy Act gets ratified. But I don't really know how that's finally going to look.
I suspect they will not be issuing any sort of prescriptive standard like PCI, but it would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah, and as I said, there has been, it's a little bit different, but there has been a push for New South Wales government departments to be certified up to 27,001. You know, in Queensland, we have a standard called IS18, which is Queensland government's equivalent of 27,001, which departments need to be compliant with. You know, and part of that is privacy, etc.
Yeah, so, of course, you've got ACSI 33 for the federal government, don't you?
That's right, yeah.
Okay, well, Tim Smith from Bridgepoint, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business.
My pleasure. Thanks, Patrick.
Tim Smith from Bridgepoint, they're a gold partner of our sponsor, Checkpoint Software. And that pretty much takes us to the end of the show. I should just thank Checkpoint again for making the show possible this week. Oh, now on next week's show, we'll be chatting with the head of Australia's Internet Industry Association, Peter Koronius, about a shelved plan to introduce a national two-factor authentication regime. It's a really interesting plan, but it never got off the ground. Not yet, anyway. So, yeah, interesting discussion, and there could be some cues or some clues to our future in that interview, and that's all coming up next week. And, of course, we'll have a news segment for you and all sorts of our regular good stuff. Now, the track you can hear in the background there is by a well and truly defunct band called Three. You cannot buy this track anywhere. The band had two members, a singing bass player and a drummer. And this tune's called Black. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.